From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the show, UC Davis brewing expert Charlie Bamforth and his new book, Beer is Proof God Loves Us. Also a Sacramento 7-year-old who sings with the acclaimed San Francisco Boys Chorus, and new indie rock and pop releases on this week's Sound Advice. But first, California's budget problems are much worse than ever before. So said Governor-elect Jerry Brown at a budget forum yesterday in Sacramento. The state faces a $6 billion deficit in the current fiscal year and another $19 billion next year. And that means Brown and lawmakers have tough decisions ahead. Earlier this week on Insight, we talked with John Kupal of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association and Mike Harold of the Western Center on Law and Poverty to get their ideas about what could be done to fix the budget. Today we'll check in with a group that's especially concerned about budget cuts, the County Welfare Directors Association of California. Just this week, Governor Schwarzenegger proposed cutting billions from the Health and Human Services budget. In our studio is Kathy Senderling-McDonald, Deputy Executive Director of the County Welfare Directors Association of California. Kathy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
How concerned are you and welfare directors about what's ahead?
Well, obviously very concerned. It would be impossible to sit here and think that we're in a situation that's good. The budget numbers that you just gave are, everyone knows these numbers. They're huge, the deficit that faces the state. And clearly our programs have been something that people have looked at for years now and cut for years as a result.
What kind of cuts have welfare budgets in general at the state level had over the last few years?
I'm glad you asked. There's a perception that the sector, the human services sector, is very fast growing and that we must do something to keep it from growing. In reality, the sector has been cut for a period of 10 years now. Our cuts started back earlier in the decade when the dot-com bubble burst. The economy was flying high. The cuts started to happen. And so what has happened over the 10 years is that every program that county human services departments administer on behalf of the state has been cut in some way, whether it be funding being cut that would allow us to just keep pace with the cost of doing business, to direct cuts to program services, cuts to grants for families, and vetoes from the governor as well to the programs.
People define cuts differently. Some people say that if growth wasn't as big as expected, that that's a cut. But some people say, well, no, that's not necessarily a real cut. If we take into account inflation and population growth, how are California's welfare budgets today compared to, say, 10 years ago?
If we had kept pace with growth, we would have over $1 billion more in the system. What has happened is that the programs that the counties run, for example, the food stamp program, the CalWORKs program, the child welfare program, and other programs, all have been held at the 2000-2001 cost of living and cost of having our social workers to investigate abuse and neglect, for example. So over 10 years, what that means is costs have gone up. Everything goes up, cost of utilities and everything. And so the number of staff, the number of people that you can buy for that same dollar has gone down over time. And so we would view that as a cut because it means fewer services going to children and to families.
Kathy Senderling-McDonald is Deputy Executive Director of the County Welfare Directors Association of California. Your association represents the county welfare directors. Can't the counties bring in money themselves if they're not getting as much from the state?
Well, there's a lot of limitations on revenue-raising authority at the county level. That's something that seems like it's going to be a discussion in Sacramento this year in the budget. It certainly was a discussion last year, this idea of can we devolve some of the services, and then how does the funding go along with that? Is it funding that would be guaranteed for counties to provide services, or would counties be given greater revenue-raising authority than they do now? What happens with that, though, Jeffrey, is that you have 58 counties that are in 58 different situations with their boards of supervisors and with their local public. And so you would have 58 possible different scenarios and abilities to raise revenue. It would not be the same for every county and their ability to do that.
You said that these are discussions that could be happening and maybe have already started. But generally speaking, as far as you know, are the counties interested in devolving responsibilities from the state to the county level? And is the state interested in that?
I think that the conversation is starting already. And from our work last year with the county supervisors, who we work with very closely, they are essentially my board of directors, the human services directors. They're our bosses. They're the elected supervisors in the counties. We're very interested in having the conversation. The key questions, I think, are, if you're going to do that, which programs and services make the most sense to move to a local level where they might end up differing from one county to the next? And then how do you make sure that the revenues are there? And if that's not going to be something that's done on a statewide basis, are they things that if the local board is unable to get the voters to agree or cannot get the necessary votes on the board to raise the revenues, are folks okay with the possible elimination or cutback of those services?
Of all the cuts that are being talked about right now, Governor Schwarzenegger, who's only in office for a few more weeks, outlined proposed cuts this week. They've been described as dead on arrival because he'll be out of office soon. So who knows what will happen. But given the size of the deficit this year and next year, it's hard to imagine that there won't be big cuts. Of all the cuts that are being talked about, tell us which one concerns you the most and why.
I think the elimination of the CalWORKS program, this is our state's welfare and cash assistance program that serves families and children, is of great concern. It's obviously a provocative proposal, one that the legislature has rejected numerous times before, as recently as last May. The idea that you could pull billions of dollars out of the state's economy by eliminating that program and turning away billions of federal dollars that we receive to run the program just seems like it would be so devastating to the economy. We know that, for example, human services programs generate economic activity well beyond every dollar that you spend. A study in 2009 by Beacon Economics found $1.32 in economic activity generated for every dollar that you spend. And so it's not like you can just flip a switch and pull that money out of the economy and without understanding the ramification of the lost jobs that are going to result from that, and not just in the CalWORKS program or in the county, but also the ripple effect that that has in our communities.
The advocates for the poor say that a recession as we're in now, and I know that technically we're not in a recession, but it sure feels like it, that a recession is the time that you need a strong safety net. And yet, unlike the federal government, the state of California can't print money. They have to balance the budget. Now, they find smoke and mirrors and all sorts of things and kicking cans down the road and so on, all sorts of metaphors to put off tough decisions. But still, given the overall size of health and human services, how can you possibly balance the state of California's budget without cuts to the welfare programs?
Well, first, to agree with what you said and what other advocates have said on the program, that a recession is precisely the time you need a strong safety net. We've seen demand growing for our programs because of lost jobs and cutbacks. And so the idea that you can just cut your way out of this situation seems really counterintuitive. That said, if I just sat here and said, don't cut these programs ever, that's bad. It's clearly not realistic for the conversation that we've got to have to solve this budget crisis. I think making sure that there's a balanced approach, and by that I mean not just cuts, and if there, to the extent that there are cuts, not just in one program sector, but thinking about the entire state budget and what we can do across the state budget to creatively maintain core services for families and for Californians, things that people care about and that are important for our communities, rather than just targeting one area of government is very important.
If Governor-elect Brown were to call you to his office and ask for your advice on what to do about welfare in general in the context of the state budget, what would you recommend he do or consider?
I think a couple of things. One is that we need to identify core services and then work together to make those services as efficient as possible. We've been doing that with the current administration, with the Schwarzenegger administration. We want to continue doing that. An example, Jeffrey, there are things in our programs that just don't make sense. In our CalWORKS program, for example, you cannot have a car that's worth more than $4,850. That's pretty low. I mean, think about your cars. Everyone listening, think about your cars. They're probably worth more than $4,800. And so what we've got is eligibility workers who have so many cases that they can barely keep their heads above water consulting the Kelley Blue Book to find out what your car is worth. If it's too much, we make you get rid of it. We then find you eligible for CalWORKS. And the first thing that happens when we get you in the office is we say, now, how can we help you get a job? and the person says, you just made me get rid of my car. It doesn't make any sense. And so looking at rules like that, that we don't think would add a great cost to the programs if you eliminated them, but would really help people get back to work, is one step, one thing that I'd recommend.
But you're talking there about making things more efficient and rational rather than identifying a core service.
Well, I would argue that helping people in this economy figure out ways to get back into the workforce is a really core service that government can help. If the private sector is not creating jobs, are there ways that we can partner with the private sector? For example, creating subsidized employment slots through our CalWORKS program. That's something that counties have done over the last year using federal stimulus dollars that have since dried up. We created 47,000 jobs, in fact, across the state. What we'd like to try to do is have a conversation with the new administration. How can we tap into those private partnerships that we created to continue creating those jobs and help jumpstart the economy and get us going again?
Okay, so we had an imaginary conversation between you and Governor-elect Brown there, but it's one thing for the County Welfare Directors Association to talk with Democrats like Jerry Brown and Daryl Steinberg, but there are important conversations to be had with the Republicans. They're the minority party in both parts of the legislature, but they are able to block tax increases. So what's your best case to them?
I think thinking about, again, the balance and the idea of jobs in the economy, how can we use the public sector and our partnerships with the private sector to get our economy going, to get people back to work, and then let the private sector do its job and take care of that. Get the jobs going, help them create the jobs, and then ideally the engine will kick in and they'll be able to maintain those jobs, hire people on full-time and on a permanent basis. Thinking about the idea that just saying don't leap to cuts doesn't mean that programs can't evolve and change. And so how do we talk with them? What we'll need to do is figure out ways to creatively do that and not decimate the programs, but make them stronger going forward, despite them being leaner.
Kathy Senderling McDonald, Deputy Executive Director of the County Welfare Directors Association of California. We've been continuing a discussion of suggestions for how the state of California could balance its budget over the next 18 months or so. Kathy, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, UC Davis brewing expert Charlie Bamforth and his new book, Beer is Proof God Loves Us. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can follow us on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter. Go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight, for links and more information about our program. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, how realistic is the 2014 deadline to pull U.S. and other NATO troops out of Afghanistan? Remember that the withdrawal depends on how ready Afghanistan's army and police are. Also, the best American comics of 2010. Beer is Proof God Loves Us. That's the provocative title of the new book by Charlie Bamforth. He is a professor of malting and brewing sciences at the UC Davis Department of Food Science and Technology. He's a world-renowned expert on the science of brewing. He joins us now to talk about the soul of beer and brewing. Charlie, welcome back to Insight.
Very nice to be here again.
Now, at the very start of your book, you talk about how Benjamin Franklin is commonly thought to have said, beer is proof God loves us, or something along those lines, but it turns out he didn't really.
No, he didn't. He was actually writing to somebody called Morellet, and he was writing about wine, which is a real shock to the system when I first discovered that. But I'm sure he was thinking about beer.
I'm sure your wine colleagues at UC Davis were interested to hear that.
There was a very wry smile from those guys, but I'm sure he drank both of these fine beverages.
Yes. Nevertheless, it's the title of your book, and as I understand, you started out writing a book that was connected to God, but rather different from what this book ended up being.
Yeah, I mean, there are different parts to my life, and in my private life, I do a lot of reading about Buddhism and religion and so on. And you know, when you're in the brewing profession and when you're a beer guy, people feel you're some sort of dark influence. But beer actually, there's a very spiritual element to it. And what I tried to get across in the book is the middle way, the middle ground, that everything in moderation, whether it's the attitudes to beer, on the one hand, the extremists who would ban it right the way through to the other extreme where people abuse it, and that in many other examples of how to take the middle way when it comes to beer.
My guest is Charlie Bamforth of UC Davis. He's the Anheuser-Busch Endowed Professor of Malting and Brewing Sciences at the UC Davis Department of Food Science and Technology, and his new book is called Beer is Proof God Loves Us. Well, one quick example that comes to my mind about a connection between spirituality and beer is the common practice of monks in Belgium and other places who make beer.
Absolutely. I mean, beer has been associated with the church for hundreds and thousands of years. And indeed, some of the latter-day brewing processes were very much refined in the monasteries. Still to this day, there are some very renowned Trappist beers that are mostly brewed in Belgium, but one in Holland. Probably the biggest is actually in Holland. And these are quite strong beers. So these monks are drinking these strong beers, and they're not going around kicking one another, but they're quietly praying and savouring this fine nectar.
Why do they make beer? Is it purely and simply for refreshment, or is there some a religious practice associated with it?
Beer has seldom been associated overtly with religious practice. That's the preserve of wine. But certainly in terms of a staple drink that the monks historically would have drunk through the day from, in the days before tea and so on, they were drinking ales and beers. And, of course, it had nutritional value, and, of course, was a mellowing influence as well.
You said the beer had nutritional value. I mean, I guess all beers or most beers have some, but did the beers that they made and still do make, are they particularly nutritious?
Not especially so. I mean, there is nutritive value in all beer. And, of course, a lot of this stems from the raw materials, the malt. And there are materials like silicon that come from the malt that is beneficial for bones. From the hops, and there are phytochemicals in the hops which have got benefits as well. And, of course, the alcohol as well, which is the key ingredient that cuts down the risk of your blood vessels from blocking.
You said these monks would drink their ales, which are often strong ales, throughout the day, which I have to ask, how are they able to do their monkish things when they're drinking strong beer all the time?
Steadily, I'm sure. But there will have been beers of different strengths as well, you know. And if you go back, not only in the monasteries, you go back to the Middle Ages, long before the days of tea and coffee, and ale was the drink throughout the day and for the whole family. So they would have something called small beer, which is the weaker, lower alcohol products that the children would drink. The stronger first brews, the stronger runnings would go on to make the higher alcohol brews that the people would drink of adult age.
Charlie Bamforth's new book is Beer is Proof God Loves Us. Does beer show up in the Bible? We know, of course, the famous story about the wine at the wedding party. What about beer?
It does, and it depends upon the translation. In older translations, you won't find the word beer. But in more modern translations of the Bible, what was before that translated into strong drink. In more modern translations, it's translated into beer. And of course, it would have been there. It's a product that has been around for 8,000 years. And it was hard to imagine that people who would feature in the Bible would not actually also be drinking beer.
So they were drinking beer in the Middle East thousands of years ago?
Yes, absolutely. And I would like to say it's the basis of modern civilization, because when they discovered beer, they ceased their nomadic existence and they stayed put while they grew the grain and made the bread that was converted into the beer.
You mentioned earlier your personal interest in Buddhism. Is there a connection between Buddhism and beer?
Not overtly, and indeed, what you will find is in the precepts of Buddhism. Actually, they caution you against employment in intoxicants. But so I've had to come to terms with that. On the other hand, in Tibet, they do have a barley-based product there called chang, which is quite clearly beer. So there's a lot of Buddhists drink beer.
We asked Insight friends and Capital Public Radio friends on Facebook to tell us what their favorite beers are and why. And we heard from quite a few people, and I'll read a couple of them just to get your reactions. We heard from someone called Clinton, who says, my all-time favorite beer is a seasonal stout that comes out around the month of July from Stone Brewery, Stone Russian Imperial Stout, and he says it's 10.5% alcohol. Are you familiar with that beer?
I am familiar with the beer, and I'm clearly familiar with other Imperial Stouts as well, which historically were quite alcoholic, and they originated at the time of beers being shipped from England to the Imperial Court of Russia. And they needed to be quite alcoholic and quite bitter to survive the sea journey. There are a range of very excellent products of that type as well. Yeah, 10%, you know, that's beer
serious.
To sip and savor slowly.
And Clinton says it has a roasted coffee taste. Some people might go, I don't know if I like the sound of that.
Well, the basic one of the main ingredients is a roasted malt and roasted grain. And it's very similar to roasting coffee, you know. And so what you would actually get is the same sort of burnt notes. But when they're in balance, the classic, of course, stout, which is lower alcohol, of course, is Guinness. And that has got that classic roast character as well. And in the right occasion, in the right glass, at the right time, of course, is an excellent product.
Also on Facebook, Jonathan said he's also a fan of Stones, but he likes the seasonal barley wine. So there seems to be a lot of Stone Brewery fans out there. Where is Stone Brewery?
Down in San Diego. And it's the famous beer is, I'm not sure if I can use both words on air, but the first word of that beer is arrogant. But and many of the listeners may know the beer I'm referring to. But it's one of many excellent breweries in California. And of course, there are many breweries right across the states around the world that are making fabulous beers.
Here's one other person who spoke to us on Facebook, Brian. He said his favorite beer at the moment, Pabst. It's cheap, and he says it still tastes better than Bud. As the Anheuser-Busch Endowed Professor at UC Davis, what do you think of that?
Well, I'm not going to comment directly on that statement, but what I do say is, you know, some of these gently flavored North American beers, which many people like to decry and like to criticize, actually, of themselves, they're very, very carefully brewed, and they're very consistent, and they're very excellent. They use traditional processes. If people question me and they say, well, you know, things like rice and corn are not traditional, let me remind you that Sir Walter Raleigh, when he first brewed in this country, his beer was made out of corn. So some of these things go way back. So Bud, Pabst Blue Ribbon, they are excellent beers. And there are different beers for different people. And one of the things I say in the book is it's fine to like gently flavored beers. It's also fine to like very strongly flavored beers. And what I like and what you like may not necessarily coincide.
Charlie Bamforth's book is Beer is Proof God Loves Us. You know, in the food, in the realm of food, there's a lot of interest nowadays in local food, growing your own food, and in slow food. And it seems to me that there are several reasons behind that. But part of it is, for some people at least, there's a spiritual element to it.
Yeah.
Is there an equivalent in beer?
Well, I think there may well be in terms of local produce and local, in the same like local beers. There's a lot to be said for that. And indeed, not so much spiritual, but quality-wise, beer is best when it's close to the brewery. And hasn't traveled too far. So there's a lot to be said for drinking beer from your local brewer.
And what about the experience of making your own beer?
Well, that's something I've never done. I've been in the brewing profession for 32 years, and I've never gone home and brewed beer, but why would I? I mean, you don't go home and have a radio show from home beer. So, but, you know, lots of people are very interested in brewing their own beer, and that's fine. That's an interesting thing. As long as they do it, in my opinion, as long as they do it properly and they look after matters of hygiene and so on, it's a very rewarding, a very fulfilling thing for those people.
Yeah, when I was still living in Scotland, I got into the home brewing thing just once, and the result was horrific.
Well, the basic advice I give to most people is go to a professional. But if you do take care with the cleanliness of the materials you're using to brew the beer, then you can get some very interesting results.
Yeah. Any other things to tell us about the soul of beer and brewing?
Well, as again, I say, it's the middle way that I like to take. I think moderation is a word I use extremely often. And it's okay to enjoy your beer, the beer you like, and it's okay to savor it. And you're not a sinner if you're drinking beer, in my opinion. And it actually might be doing you some good as well.
No doubt. Charlie Bamforth, he's Anheuser-Busch Endowed Professor of Malting and Brewing Sciences in the UC Davis Department of Food Science and Technology. His new book is Beer is Proof God Loves Us, Reaching for the Soul of Beer and Brewing. Charlie, thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And you can continue the beer conversations, if you wish, on our Facebook page and Capital Public Radio's page. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, a 7-year-old Sacramento who travels to the Bay Area twice a week to sing with the San Francisco Boys Chorus. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us if you wish. We're at insight@capradio.org. Tomorrow, it's been a busy week at the state capitol. New lawmakers sworn in, Governor Schwarzenegger proposing new cuts, and Governor-elect Brown getting an early start on next year's budget. We'll get an update on all this from Capital Public Radio's Marianne Russ. Also, California's planned high-speed rail system has been in the news a lot recently, including controversy over the first stretch of track it plans to build in the Central Valley. We'll talk with the High-Speed Rail Authority's new CEO. Driving to the Bay Area just once every so often can be a bit of a nuisance. Imagine doing it twice a week. Imagine if you're just 7 years old and you're doing it because you sing in a choir. Well, that's what Tanishq Matthew Abraham does. He's a 7-year-old. He sings in the world-famous San Francisco Boys Chorus. They've got a concert, a winter concert, this Saturday evening. Tanishq joins us in our studio along with his mom and dad, who are Taji and Bijou. Welcome all to Insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Tanishq, what's it like driving to the Bay Area twice a week to sing in your choir?
It's actually, it's like a long drive, so it's like I have to, like, sleep all the time.
I wish I could do that when I drive to the Bay Area.
Yeah, but when I come back, I do other stuff like learn. And also, I might read a book when I come back.
And is it worth it, doing this long drive twice a week? Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I like to go to the singing class.
Yes.
And I learn many songs. Usually, we, like, have 5-6 songs. But we don't sing all the songs, so that's the...
When did you start singing? Do you remember?
Singing... In the choir,
well, just singing for your pleasure.
Probably like around 4 or 5.
Yeah. Well, let's check in with your mom, Taji. When do you remember Tanishq first singing?
Yeah, that's right. About probably around 4 or 5, he started showing talent and kind of like singing, vocal singing. But in music, per se, it started like around 2, 2.5, and we saw that his interest in the keyboard or the piano came up around that age. So, yeah.
So, Tanishq, you play the piano, too?
Yeah. And I learned a lot of songs. And I've been with, like, now 3 piano teachers.
Really?
Yeah.
You go through them. can you play the piano and sing at the same time? Because there are some good musicians really struggle to do that. I mean, I can play the piano a bit. I'm a terrible singer, and I certainly can't do both at the same time. Can you?
Not yet.
Not yet, but maybe one day.
Yeah.
Bijou is Tanishq's dad. Bijou, are you musical?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I like to sing, but I'm not. I don't think I'm professional or anything like that. But
yeah,
I can keep a tune.
You can keep a
yeah,
tune.
That's one thing I was going to say. He's a better singer than I am because I just can't sing for nuts. So.
I see. So where did the music? Where did Tanishq's music talent come from? Do you know?
It's actually there in the family, like from both sides of our family, we have pretty good singers. Like my cousin, actually, he's an opera singer with the IU now, with Indiana University. And my husband's cousin, she's actually a singer with the San Francisco Symphony, and she's an opera singer too. So I guess it probably runs in the family, I don't know, but somewhere in the genes it's there.
Wow, well, it sounds like it. My guests are Tanishq Abraham, who's a 7-year-old who sings in the San Francisco Boys Chorus, also with us, his mom and dad, Taji and Bijou. Let's listen to a clip of the San Francisco Boys Chorus rehearsing recently. Taji, when were these clips recorded?
Last week during his rehearsals. They normally have about 3 or 4 all-campus rehearsals for the concert. So this was one of those. I just recorded it while they were rehearsing.
So this isn't professionally recorded.
Yeah, so you might hear some teacher, like the conductor saying, oh, you're doing a good job. Oh, we have to make corrections here. So yes, it's not something.
Well, let's start with the song Hanukkah Holiday. It's Hanukkah Holiday. It's a rehearsal by part of the San Francisco Boys Chorus. Tanish, one thing I really like in that is when y'all clap like that. But y'all do it at the same time.
And we actually say, hey.
Tanish, when I'm watching you and the other boys singing, I don't see any books with the words. Do you know all the words in your head?
What we really do is actually, we learn them at our campus with music sheets, and then we start doing it without the words, and then that's how we now.
Very good. Bijou, where about is the campus when you or Taji are driving Tanish to the rehearsals? Where are they?
The campus is in Oakland. It's the Cathedral of Light. It's a Catholic church there, and there the San Francisco Boys Choir is the in-house choir, I guess, for that church. So they're there. I don't know exactly where. It's in Oakland.
Yes, that's okay. But it's in Oakland anyway. Taji, this must be a big commitment for you and for Bijou, let alone Tanish, because you're driving him to and fro twice a week.
Yeah, that's right. It is. Last year, pretty much I was chauffeuring him around to the Bay Area, but this year Bijou graciously volunteered to pitch in for the drives. And we'd also like to say our 3-year-old daughter, she really cooperated with us very well, because I think so without that we would be probably backed out from the situation. And she even still goes with the flow, and she picks up lots of Tanish's music, and I think so we might probably have her in not in boys' chorus, but they do have a San Francisco girls' chorus, so probably we might think of.
Tanish, there are several levels within the San Francisco Boys Chorus. What level are you singing in?
Now I'm in apprentice, and when I entered, I was in junior apprentice, which is also called JA, but I was really supposed to be in prep.
Actually, we had to go in for an audition. That's how it worked. Last year, we saw an ad and we put him for audition. And we thought since he's just starting out, they'll have him as a prep in the prep level, which is just level one. It's a prep class, and where they just start out early boys in there. And we were surprised when we got the result back. They said, oh, he's going to be in the JA class. And we said, okay. So actually, it's more of a commitment being a JA class, because preps only go for less than an hour. And this is more of a commitment. So anyway, but it worked out well.
I'm in an apprentice, which is when I was in JA, it was supposed to be 1 hour, but now it's 2 hours.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
When I look at the video, the video clips where we got these excerpts from, y'all look quite young. Y'all look like you're about 7. Is that fair to say?
Actually, some are 8 and 9. Actually.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm the only one who is 7 years old there.
Oh, so you're one of the younger ones.
Because I skipped the prep. So that's why I'm...
he's one of the younger ones in the
whole of the apprentice. Yeah, and they have about 45... Among the 3 campuses, they have about 45 boys choristers in that level.
Well, let's listen to another clip of Tanish and other members of the San Francisco Boys Chorus. The song is Virgin Mary.
He comes from the glorious kingdom. He comes from the glory. Yes, he comes. He comes from the glory.
And we can hear the conductor of the rehearsal speaking there in the background. Now, Tanishq, along with all these Christmas and other winter songs, you recently sang the national anthem at a San Francisco Giants game. Tell us about that.
Actually, I sang two times the national anthem, one at the Oakland A's and also at the Giants. And
which one did you prefer singing at, the A's or the Giants?
I prefer, we did more, like, better at the Oakland A's, which was the first one.
Yes.
And I like that one a lot.
Are you a fan of either team?
I'm mostly the Giants, of course.
Well, that's a good team to be a fan of.
Yeah.
He's a big Tim Lincecum fan.
Yeah, that's why he's crazy about Tim Lincecum. And
so there's a concert this Saturday, December 11th, the San Francisco Boys Chorus. Taji, where about is the concert and when?
It's on Saturday, December 11th at the Calvary Presbyterian Church. It's 2515 Fillmore Street, and it's from 2 to 4 p.m. And it's after, I think it's after the concert, they have a post-performance reception, which is you get all kinds of yummy things to eat. And that's what most of the choristers look forward to after the concert.
Well, so, no doubt.
Yeah.
And this is not just the apprentices, but it's the whole range of the San Francisco Boys Chorus.
That's right, about 240 boys. So that's something to really see.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tanishq. Abraham, thanks for joining us and talking
you for
about your
having me.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure. And Taji and Biju, Tanishq's parents, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, new indie rock and pop releases on this week's Sound Advice. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, an environmental group says, don't feel bad cutting down a tree for Christmas. According to the Nature Conservancy, it is, on balance, the green thing to do. That story and much more during All Things Considered here on Capital Public Radio. It's time now for our weekly music feature, Sound Advice. Capital Public Radio music hosts and other music experts join us with new releases they recommend. With me today is Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online indie music show. Nick, welcome back.
Happy to be back, Jeffrey.
And before we continue, let's first of all acknowledge the 100th show of Off Air, which happened last week.
Yes, we hit the century mark. I'm a fan of big round numbers for no particular reason, and 100 is one of those numbers that turns people's heads and perks their ears up. So I thought I'd make a big deal out of it by giving away every single CD that we had on our shelf.
Wow. And did you succeed in giving them away?
We did indeed. We had 17 winners that we divvied up. They're going to be getting several pieces of mail over the next couple of days. So
since the show's weekly and you just had the 100th show, that means you've been doing it for just under 2 years. Given the cutthroat, highly competitive world of public radio, did you expect to make the two-year mark?
Well, I really didn't think of it in terms like that. I just sort of thought I'd do it and do it until somebody said, stop doing that. And luckily, no one said, stop doing that yet. Yeah.
Great. Well, let's play some music. What are we going to start with today?
I am frankly enamored by the new album from Mr. Jonathan Richman.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yes, yes. I figured you might be, considering his history.
I've been a fan of his since the late 70s, believe it or not.
The Modern Lovers, right?
The Modern Lovers, yes.
Oh, man. And, so his sound now differentiates greatly from the sound of the Modern Lovers. He's, of course, he's lyrical, but he is just a romantic singer. I mean, his muses are art, love, and beauty, at least over the last couple records. And his newest album just exemplifies that greatly. It's called O Moon, Queen of Night on Earth.
Great.
And this is my favorite track from that album.
Savoir au livre, savoir Matisse, comme un rêve inconnu, comme un rêve jamais vu. That's right. Her voice stirs me up like a street you've never gone down before. An unknown road. savoir, olive, her olive-colored voice. Olive et brun, brown too.
A beautiful French franche intonation from Jonathan Richman.
Indeed, and he almost leads you in a sing-along for those of us not inclined to be speaking French. And I misspoke. That's actually one of my favorite tracks. The other one is called My Affected Accent, which is very self-deprecating and wry and very funny. But what I love about this is it's a reprise, it's simple, it's sweet, and it just reminds me of, I don't know, everything that's good in the world, if that's not too big a generalization.
Sounds good to me. Nick Brunner, host of Off Air, joins us with sound advice. What's next?
Next is a cut from Japan Droids. They have been a favorite of mine for the last year or so, and they've embarked on this kind of ambitious 7-inch project. 2010, they have an incredible touring schedule, so they can't release a proper follow-up to their 2009 records. What they're doing is releasing about 5 or 6 7-inch vinyl EPs. And they're on about 3 or 4 right now. This is the A-side to their latest. It's called Heavenward Grand Prix.
Love that wall, that distorted wall that's just in the background.
It's very Who-esque in a lot of ways. And it's just it's their typical fuzzy, frantic guitar sound. But what's not typical is on the B side of every one of these 7-inches is a cover by one of their favorite bands of that they have covered. So on this particular one, it's a PJ Harvey song. On their first one, it was a track by Big Black and so on and so forth.
I wish we had a turntable in our studio so we could play the 7-inch vinyl versions of these songs.
Absolutely, but, me too.
Yeah. It seems like you're often sharing new releases with us and talking about the vinyl versions of it. Is there more interest in vinyl now? I mean, I know it never went away, but it seems like there's a lot of vinyl nowadays.
There's definitely a resurgence just from my own experience, and I've been buying a lot more vinyl personally, and I noticed that when you go to record stores like The Beat, their brand new music encompasses a lot of vinyl as well as CD. It's starting to even out again because that's how you collect music these days. People are less interested in CDs because why have the CD and the tiny artwork when you could just do that on iTunes or you could do that digitally with a PDF file? If you're really wanting to collect things, vinyl is making a big resurgence.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. What's our third piece for today?
Some really kind of chilled out, laid back electronic music from a Norwegian duo called Røyksopp, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I like them so much. I have a couple of their records, but I've never gotten a full, complete pronunciation to the name of the record, the name of the album. Band, that is. Røyksopp. Their new album is called Senior, and this is called The Fear.
Imagine driving at night with that music.
There's almost a disco-laden kind of element to that track as well. And this record is really for people who love the early career work of the French electronic duo called Air.
Yes. We got time for a couple more tracks.
All right. Well, this was interesting. This was released as a Record Store Day limited edition vinyl Black Friday single. And it's from the one-man band called Iron and Wine, Walking Far From Home.
So a white dog chases its tail, and a pair of hearts carved into a stone. I saw kindness and an angel. widows in the temple to the Lord. Naked dancers in the city, how they spoke for us all, spoke for us all.
Sounds like it could almost be a folk song, but with a very pop rock sensibility behind it.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because predominantly Iron and Wine is a folk music act. It's really very quiet, kind of cabin in the woods sort of music. And I was really surprised to hear such an electronic element to this release.
Yeah. You usually feature music on Off Air, but there's usually some comedy. Who's the comic this week?
This week is Greg Proops, and a lot of people in America might know him as the comic from, what is it, not Last Comic Standing, it's the, Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yes,
the improv
right.
show.
Yes.
Yeah, well, he had did a great run on that, and he's been a voice on many children's television shows, too, especially over the last couple of years, but I had no idea what a politically minded, acerbic guy this is. And his new EP is called Proops Digs In. I highly recommend it. It's very Lenny Bruce. It's very, like, he knows he's like playing up the character. That he's like, yeah, I'm smart, and I'm going to throw out all these references and just boom, 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 rapid fire. And if you get them, great. And if not, I'm going to move on. And I might make fun of you for not getting them. So he's really kind of almost challenging the listening audience to be as smart or smarter than he is.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think of him in that way, but obviously he's very sharp and fast-moving because of his work on an improv comedy on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's our last piece of music on today's Off Air?
I got to say, it takes a lot to get me excited about a guitar solo these days because I've heard so many of them. But I went to this festival in L.A. this summer and got a chance to see this band called Screaming Females. And, well, I'm going to play this track here, and it kind of belies the high energy of it, but let's get to it, and we'll come back and talk about
okay. Yay.
It's a really sort of standard pop song, pop rock song. It's a wonderful hook to get into their album. It's called Castle Talk, by the way. But man, if you get a chance to see this band live, do it, do it, do it. The lead singer, Marissa Paternoster, is about 5 feet tall, and she has this cute little bowl haircut, and she practically just eats the microphone and just wails. And it's amazing. It's beyond words. There is a video of them up at the Off Air Facebook page, if anyone's curious.
Yeah. Now, the band is called Screaming Females, and the singer is a woman. Are they all women in the band?
No, in fact, she's the only woman.
Okay, so Screaming Female.
Yeah, in many ways, you bet.
Yes. Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online music show. You can check it out every week at smartrockradio.org. The 101st show was uploaded last night. Nick, thanks again for joining us on Insight.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Estevan Hernandez, and Susan Morar. Today's engineer, Evan Matzler. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. California's planned high-speed rail system is dealing with a lot of controversy over its Bay Area and Central Valley routes. On the next Insight, we'll talk with the High-Speed Rail Authority's new CEO. Plus, an update on what happened in this busy week at the state capitol, and we'll mark Human Rights Day. Our guest is a local professor who's an expert on Islam, human rights, and peace. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.